Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. It's a interesting season, I feel like, this one. Like, for me, it's summer. For you, it's winter. But it's, like, warm weather here. You just want to go outside, enjoy the sunshine. But at the same time, there are so many new interesting technologies from Apple to dive into. And it's kind of the same thing every year where it's like, you know, oh, I want to go to the beach today, or do I actually want to experiment with some new Swift features? It's a hard decision.
Well, Apple Silicon Macs don't get too hot, so you can take them to the beach, although I think the sand might be a problem.
Yeah, I won't say that. Like, the battery, sure, that's not an issue anymore, but the sand will definitely be an issue. Like, you can quickly turn your good keyboard into a butterfly keyboard with a bit of sand, I think.
Yeah, it's a completely different type of silicone, right?
Exactly, right. But I will say, like, you know, I continue getting really, really impressed by the M1 Max-powered MacBook Pro that I have. Like, every time I go anywhere, I have an appointment or I need to get my car serviced or something like that, like, and I have some waiting time and I do some work there, like for maybe 1 or 2 hours or something like that, like, I just feel like the battery is just so amazing. And sometimes I can do like 2 hours of work and still have 80% battery left or something. And we're talking about like Xcode work with multiple simulators and debugging. Like, it continues to kind of be mind-blowing just how much battery life you get out of these devices.
Yeah, I have the same here. Usually I'm doing work on battery for laziness purposes, basically. Just like, oh, I want to sit on the couch or something. And yeah, like even the M2 Max 16-inch, which I always run in the high power mode, which is an exclusive of the Max on 16-inch laptops. It's supposed to draw more power, and I'm sure it does, but it's like, I've been working here for 3 hours and it's at 85%. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, macOS is just so efficient when it comes to like distributing the work on those efficiency cores and so on. So yeah, it's really incredible, even when you are using like high power and actually using the performance cores as well, the distribution of different tasks and so on, like, just means that you get so much battery life, which is just fantastic.
Which means we can explore new dub-dub stuff, no matter the weather.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to do on this episode, or maybe not do the exploring here in real time, but actually talk about some of the exploration we've done. But I think on this episode in particular, we will focus on kind of what was revealed during the actual WWDC keynote and maybe along some associated sessions. And then later in an episode, maybe next month or something like that, we can talk more about kind of the different APIs that we might be adopting and so on. Because I don't know about you, Rambo, but for me, at least during the last couple of years, the approach that I've been taking when it comes to actually adopting new system APIs, like trying out the new version of Xcode and so on. Of course, I try out technologies pretty early when it comes to like Swift and so on, where I want to sometimes write about it, but also because I'm really interested in seeing all the new Swift features. But when it comes to actually applying new kind of system features into the projects that I work on, I tend to save that for a little bit later during the beta cycle. Like, I don't tend to do that right away. One thing I do do on the first beta usually is I get the new version of Xcode and I just open up the different projects I work on and press Command B just to see, like, does it build? And if it does build, if it doesn't build, then how many tasks will I have to actually make it build probably during like this period? But when it comes to actually adopting the features, I prefer that to do that a little bit later in the cycle, just so that I don't work on too much of a kind of moving target.
Yeah, definitely. I famously developed the initial version of Chibi Studio during the beta cycle when we were transitioning, I think, from Swift 3 to Swift 4. And that was a nightmare. Like, each new beta of Xcode, nothing would build and I would have to do the whole conversion again. It's not as bad these days, but yeah, you do get like beta 1 type issues, or sometimes beta 1 is kind of okay, but then beta 2 breaks everything. So it is a moving target. And unless you are actually planning on shipping something on day one, like a new app or maybe adopting a new feature on day one, I don't think it's worth it to go through the hassle of having to deal with this moving target. And then you can just wait and see, just do a quick check to see if everything still compiles. Maybe if it doesn't, check the release notes to make sure it's not like a known issue that you're facing. And then wait a little bit, like maybe until the public betas go out. That's, I think, when things start to shape up.
Yeah, I think so too. I usually give it like a month and a half, something like that. So we're like right in the middle of that beta period. That's when I also feel like things usually start to stabilize a little bit more, and then you can actually start doing some actual development against the new version of Xcode. Because I do also like to get on the beta version of Xcode as early as it's kind of practically possible, because that way I also feel like I'm prepared for when it becomes the real version of Xcode later in the year. And another kind of tip that I have, or something that I do, is I also like to just do a preview of what it will be like to bump my minimum deployment targets. So usually what I do during what is the summer for me and the winter for you, Rambo, is that I opened up the project in an early version of the Xcode beta, and then I just increase my deployment target. So in this case, it will be to iOS 17, to actual the version that is shipping this year, even though I will probably in most projects go to iOS 16 this year. So it will be 17 and 16, right? Yeah. But I like to get that preview. And the reason for that is because there are many deprecation warnings that only activates once you do that bump. Right. And that can be very useful information, because sometimes some APIs will be kind of soft deprecated, where they do the thing where they say, this will be deprecated in iOS version like 10,000 in the header file. And then they will turn into hard deprecations in like the next OS version. And then I can know that up front and start maybe adopting a new API a little bit sooner if it's available, so that I don't get that shock like the day where I bump my deployment target and I have like 1,000 deprecation warnings.
Yeah, my currently like the least favorite thing to me about supporting previous OS versions is that many times you get deprecations, but the replacement API is only available on the latest OSs. So that's a little bit of an issue, but at least you don't get the warnings when you build, because Xcode knows that your deployment target is below the version that introduced the deprecation. So it is good to do that preview. However, I do get a problem, and I should probably file a feedback about this, but when you use code completion, it will ignore your deployment target, basically. And I'm often seeing, especially when using SwiftUI these days, which I at least in everybody, I back deploy all the way to Big Sur with version 3. And I will get like, oh, I'm trying to use this API in SwiftUI, but it's like grayed out in the autocomplete dialog. And like your brain automatically goes like, oh, I shouldn't use that. But actually, no, I need to use that, because that's what works in the version that I back deploy to. So I do wish they'd be better at maybe having a single source of truth and syncing those feedbacks to the developer, because it can be quite annoying to always have that nagging feeling that you're using an API that you shouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where those soft deprecation warnings kind of come into play, right? Like there's, I've also encountered that quite a lot. Like for example, when they made a lot of changes to the navigation system in iOS 16, they deprecated a bunch of modifiers related to the older system, and they want you to use like the new toolbar APIs, for example, instead of using the navigation bar APIs directly. And those will be grayed out, even though I can't use them in a specific project, because I also need to back deploy, right? So yeah, that can be tricky. That's kind of a never-ending challenge, I feel like, with iOS Mac development, or probably for most platforms, that you, when you need to support multiple versions, you have to be careful about which APIs you call. And thankfully, like the warnings you do get and the errors you do get are usually very helpful, that you don't accidentally ship something that's not going to work on someone's older OS version. So that's great. But it is sometimes tricky to kind of juggle all those warnings and those different APIs as you're doing your development.
Right. But I do think they've been doing a lot better in that regard, especially this year with the new back deploy attribute, I guess, that some things get. So I was watching the What's New in AppKit session, and would you believe it, John? NSView now has a clips to bounds property. How amazing is that?
Oh, finally. What technology? What kind of world we live in where that is possible? It's amazing.
Yeah, and it back deploys all the way back to Mavericks.
That's impressive. Yeah. That's I'm very happy that they have invested in that kind of technology. We've actually talked about it quite a bit on the show, right? And we were imagining even like being able to back deploy entire libraries, and we're not quite there yet, but individual APIs is really great that they have that emit into client kind of attribute where they can emit the code into your actual consuming app bundle or app binary. And that way you're kind of shipping a little back compatible version of that API with your app, and then it can run on older operating systems. And I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and in this case, it's not even that, because what they've done basically is they've made an API that was previously SPI or private API and just made it open. So it exists on older OSs, it's just private API, but then now it's public, so it's basically like just taking the cover off the API, like unveiling it. Here it is. You can use it now, and App Store won't block you. And there's one in UIKit as well. I think it's View is appearing instead of using View will appear. They basically recommend how they use View is appearing, which is a better place to do a bunch of things. You can watch the full video to learn more about that. But that's also something that was previously private API and is now public API. So I think it back deploys all the way to iOS 11 or something.
Yeah, that's really, really great, because that really kind of just completely removes that issue where you can't use a new API because you haven't bumped your minimum deployment target yet. So very happy to see. It feels like more and more APIs every year actually adopting that. And along with, like we've talked about also previously, a lot of the kind of heavy lifting of applications these days is done by Swift itself and the Swift standard library. And that, of course, the vast majority of those features also back deploy because you have that version of Swift that you're using in your project and it's all being compiled. And that's also great, right? So there are many advantages here of us being able to use more and more new technologies, even as we're supporting older operating systems, which is fantastic, because that's just the reality of the vast majority of projects. I would assume that you at least support like the current version -1, and some even do -2, -3, -4. And yeah, the more we can have back compatibility, the better, I think.
Yeah, as always, it depends.
Exactly. But now let's actually start diving into some of the announcements from WWDC and talk about, well, our thoughts about them from a developer's perspective, like we always do. And I think one good place to start would be to share some of the poker results of our game that we played before the keynote, because we made some interesting picks that some of them came true, some of them didn't. And I think that's just a good place to start our conversation here.
Yeah.
And the first thing we were both betting on was that XROS would be the name of Apple's headset platform for VR, AR, or spatial computing, as they call it. And that turned out not to happen. And that was interesting, where it actually kind of did happen, but it also didn't happen. So Rambo, what's going on here?
Yeah, this was very interesting, because at least in recent times, I do not remember something like this happening. And of course, we can theorize a lot about what actually happened, but if you watch WWDC session videos, it is XROS. Like, it's in slides, it's in session titles in slides. So there, I was watching a session, I think it was about something about Safari, and they were like, oh, and watch this session, and the session was titled like Safari for XROS or something like that, and it was actually in the slide. And in Xcode, like when they show how to deploy to the device, there's like XROS device. Also, like the actual SDKs and code reference XROS. So I think there are two main ways to think about this. One is they changed the name at the last minute. That's one option. And the other is that they just fooled everyone internally that this was going to be the name, because they knew it was going to leak, and it leaked, and it doesn't matter because it's not the name.
Exactly. And it could also just been kind of a project name, right? Like something to refer to this thing we're working on, and not just a series of numbers and letters, but actually like a relatively real sounding name that everyone can kind of just talk about when they have meetings and in code commits and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think they always use code names at Apple. And there was also some talk about this during the talk show with some of Apple's executives. But XROS was not a code name for them. They were under the impression that this was actually the market.
Right,
name.
It was a code name for the code name.
Exactly. So basically, they made everyone believe that it was going to be called XROS. And then, like, at the last minute, they changed everything in the keynote and things like that. But only the very top executives knew it was going to be called Vision OS. But either way, it was not called XROS in the keynote, so we didn't get those points.
Exactly. And I must say that I think that Vision OS is a better name. We were both mentioning that on the poker episode that we didn't really like XROS. Also, Reality OS, this was another candidate that was kind of talked about in the community that also I feel like Vision OS sounds like a good name, especially when you combine it with the product name and so on. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting, like you also mentioned, how, you know, there are so many references to it and so many, like even in WWDC videos that they actually mention XROS. And from my perspective, I feel like it must have been that they knew it was going to be Vision OS, but it was just like a placeholder name for the larger organization while the real name was being kept hidden in a safe in the marketing department.
Yeah, I'm sure that was the case, and very few people actually knew it.
Exactly. We'll talk way more about Vision OS and of course, the Vision Pro later in the episode. But for now, well, we're actually going to talk a little bit about it now. And that's that our next pick was that there will be a VR game demo with No Man's Sky or Resident Evil 8. Now, Resident Evil 8 was featured in the keynote. Of course it was. It has to be, right? Like every single Apple keynote, Resident Evil has to be there. But it was earlier in the keynote during the Mac gaming section where they did also share some really interesting announcements regarding the game porting toolkit and other technologies to make it easier for games to be ported to macOS. Perhaps we'll talk about that more in a future episode, but what's really interesting is we were all kind of under the assumption that gaming would at least be kind of a major feature that would be highlighted for the headset because, well, that's kind of what all the other headsets do, right? Like they do gaming and media consumption and other things, but gaming is a very big focus for VR. But here with the Vision Pro unveil, we can see that there was almost no mention of gaming at all. There was just like, oh, you can play Apple Arcade games on a virtual screen. That's it. And I thought that was really, really interesting just to see Apple taking a very, very different approach here and gaming really not being a big focus at all. And therefore, of course, this pick didn't happen. But still, I feel like that's a very, very kind of interesting and kind of telling aspect of how Apple see this device and kind of their initial approach for it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And unsurprisingly, it's what makes me more interested in the product. We were talking so much about how are they going to get Rambo excited about this product because I'm not a gamer. I don't see myself playing a lot of VR games. And turns out that they did manage to get my excitement about the product, at least a little bit.
That's great. You just don't want to see games on any platforms you use, Rambo, right? Like, no games. If there are games, I'm not interested.
Yeah, I am against that. Gaming is bad. No.
All right, so moving on to the next pick. That's one that actually did happen. We both bet $5 on it, which is great. And that's that we will see iPad apps running unmodified on the headset. So developers don't need to do any work to bring their iPad apps over to the Vision Pro and to Vision OS, which is really, really great to see. And it's also interesting when you start looking at the kind of interface idiom, if you will, or the different paradigms that are being used on the Vision Pro and Vision OS. It feels like the closest kind of sibling in the Apple family that the Vision Pro has is kind of the iPad. Like it feels kind of like what we're looking at here is quote unquote iPad class apps or iPad-ish apps, if you will. And I think that's pretty obvious if you see like actually iPad apps running side by side with native Vision OS apps, and they don't really seem that out of place.
Yeah, definitely. And so much of what Apple has been doing the past few years makes a lot of sense when you see the actual product and experience, right? So much stuff that they've been doing in AR, of course, but that's obvious, like, oh, hand pose detection and things like that. But also other things like SharePlay is a big thing, all the FaceTime enhancements, all of the cross-platform abilities that they've introduced the past few years, maybe even SwiftUI itself. Of course, we know it started as a watch thing, but I think the focus on SwiftUI might be related as well. Even Catalyst might have been something of, hey, let's prepare for having iPad apps running in a different environment. And a lot of the under-the-hood refactoring they've done on how system shells communicate with apps on Apple's platforms and making that more modular and having what I think we called in a previous episode like this OS building toolkit that they have that they can mix and match different components from different OSs and build like the quote perfect operating system for a given platform. And it's not surprising at all that this thing can just take an iPad app and run it.
Exactly. And it feels also very much so with Vision OS, especially because it is the new Apple platform, the first new big Apple platform in many years, that it's really kind of combining so many of these different technologies, like you mentioned, that they've been introducing over the last couple of years. And of course, a lot of these technologies also made complete sense in isolation. Like it makes sense that if you have an Apple Silicon Mac, you can run Apple Silicon software on it, including iPhone and iPad apps, right?
Right.
But now they're just like that investment is kind of the opposite of tech debt, right? It's like tech investment. They've invested all this in all of this technology ahead of time for other devices, and it's kind of paying off here now when they're introducing the Vision Pro and Vision OS, that they're getting all these technologies, not for free, because I'm sure they had to actually implement it and it was not very easy, but like kind of it's all coming together in this new product, which is really cool to see, I feel like.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do you think about the user interface idiom? I am really happy with how they've done it. Of course, I haven't used it. Very few people have, but the way it looks, I think it's just amazing. Like their usage of materials and translucency and integrating lighting and shadows with the environment. I think it's definitely the best AR user interface I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think it looks super cool. And also really great to have the UI be grounded in the environment if you're actually going to do augmented reality, not complete virtual reality.
Yep.
So the fact that objects do cast shadows and actually interact with your environment in different ways, like I think that's great. And I also really like actually that they went for, you could say it's still very much like a 2D interface, but it's rendered in a 3D environment. So you still have windows, you still have, you know, text that is rendered on a flat surface. And I think that's good for kind of familiarity and making the kind of jump from something like iPadOS or macOS to VisionOS be kind of smooth, that you don't end up with, oh, now all apps have to be in complete 3D and all the text you're going to read is going to like circle around you in 3D. Like, you know, it's great. I feel like that you're basically just getting a bunch of windows in augmented reality. And then, of course, they're also extending that with the volumes and the more 3D capable building blocks that you can use. And you can even build completely immersive environments as well. But that they started with like a 2D window-based approach that is familiar to so many users as kind of a starting point and then built on top of that, I feel like that's a really good approach.
Yeah, and it's also something that made me more interested in the platform because I've been talking for a long time. I think my first post on WWDC by Sandel was about like how are they going to make development for such a platform accessible to a lot of developers without like a huge investment and a huge team to create these 3D assets. And because it's not that, Rambo wants every single platform to only have indie apps or something, but this goes even beyond just indie apps. I think it's, I would say, and there's probably someone out there who's super talented who's going to prove me wrong, but I think it's impossible for an indie developer to make a fully 3D immersive app, fully functional with really high quality, photorealistic assets. I don't think that's possible. And even if you take like a small team, it's still not easy and not cheap. So I think having the ability to do this in a 2D environment, but have those little sprinkles of 3D here and there is the way to go. And not just because of how much more accessible it is to develop for, but also because it's more practical. Like, we've been using paper for how many years or decades or millennia? I don't know. I'm bad at history, as you can tell, but we've been using paper for a really long time. Paper is 2D, but paper is really useful for, like, putting stuff down and looking at it and analyzing and drawing and thinking about stuff and yeah, just doing schematics or whatever. And 3D has its place, but I don't think, like, oh, Xcode is now 3D. Like, I move blocks of 3D Lego brick code and move them around to create an app. I don't think that's very practical.
Exactly. Your source kit crash alerts are now coming at you like bullets that you have to dodge.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. I think, 3D is kind of more powerful, but more complicated, right? Like, that's in general the trade-off when we're talking about software, is that the more powerful you make it, the more kind of capabilities it has, or the more complicated it also gets. And 2D, to your point, is like something where most of us are very, very familiar with, and we've been using it for a long time, and it satisfies the needs for so many different kinds of software. But to then have the ability also to do, like, even just a part of a 2D app can become 3D. So, for example, let's say that you are working on a kind of traditional 2D app, and then you wanted to just make your, let's say, your onboarding. You want to make, like, the first time the user launches the app to be something special. Now on Vision OS, you could include, like, a 3D actual onboarding experience that is like introducing you to the app in a nice way with some cool effects and so on. And maybe you're spending a little bit more time on that. Maybe you are, you know, actually investing in some 3D models and so on for that, and maybe even writing some shaders. But then when you get into the app, you're focusing mostly on the 2D aspects that, you know, make most sense for that particular app, if that's the case. And I think, like, different situations like that will definitely arise as we start developing for this platform, where we might make select use of 3D or select use of different effects, and even show that in some of the sessions where they talk about materials, which is another aspect of kind of 3D rendering, is, and now when we're in this 3D environments, like, light reflections and materials make a lot more kind of, they have a lot more importance. And they show that just by kind of changing the material of different sections in a Swift UI view that was 2D, they could make it kind of stand out more or have a different kind of translucent background to kind of elevate the content. And I think decisions like that will also become really important in kind of Vision OS development.
Yeah, definitely.
So speaking about Swift UI, that is our next pick. And the pick was that Swift UI will be the primary framework for building user interfaces for the headset. And I did score this one as a win, that we actually got this one. We also mentioned it on the episode that it might be a little bit kind of hard to decide what is the main UI framework or primary UI framework from the keynote. But we did also mention as an example, like, if it's featured on a slide and they say something like, Swift UI is a great way to build apps for Vision OS. And that's pretty much exactly what they did. So I feel like this one definitely counts. And once you dive into the sessions as well, it's very clear that Swift UI is very, very strongly emphasized as the way to actually build those 2D UIs that we talked about with 3D capabilities. And then, of course, you have other technologies like RealityKit and ARKit to interact with more like the 3D aspects and also kind of the hand tracking and those sorts of things.
Now, John, would you tell me which Swift UI component do you use to create depth in a Swift UI app running on Vision OS? Because that was, I think, my favorite part of the platform State of the Union, was when they presented which component you use, and it was very familiar to us.
Yeah, because it was really, really funny. We were joking on our poker episode about how do you draw things in 3D with Swift UI? Well, just use ZStack, right? And it turns out that's actually what you do. And I just love that. Like, ZStack is getting a whole new kind of usage here in Vision OS, where, well, you can use it to add depth, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, I think that was amazing. And thinking about it now, it actually makes a lot of sense, right? We already have a Z stack. Z is associated with depth in programming and whatnot. So why not just use the Z stack?
Exactly. And the only difference now is that because it's a 3D environment, you can actually notice the depth, right? It's not just like actually stacking views on top of each other like we usually use Z stack for in Mac and iOS applications. So yeah, that's going to be a really interesting new use case for ZStack for sure.
Yeah.
But I think like having Swift UI as the main UI platform, that's why I even betted like we both betted high on it, because it just seems like such a clear path forward as they've been investing so much in Swift UI. And also since the rendering aspects of the actual UI we build is in a large part determined by the system itself, it just gives the system so much ability to take existing view hierarchies and just render them in a different way on VisionOS, which is kind of exactly what's happening here.
And it also makes a lot of sense that they brought the ability to do shaders directly as SwiftUI modifiers, which we joked about privately when they announced that. It's like, oh, really? I'm going to be writing shaders for SwiftUI? but it's actually an amazing capability, and I think it's another one of those escape hatches you can use for SwiftUI when you can't quite achieve the effect that you want. And we've already been seeing some people share some of their creations using shaders in SwiftUI. And I actually used the shader for a real problem solving last week.
And not on VisionOS, right? On macOS.
No. Right, yeah, because that's available on all platforms. I think maybe not the Apple Watch. I think even on the Apple Watch. So I needed to have a comparison view, basically, where you have like, say, like a before and after of an image, and you want to drag a divider in the middle to show like one version, the other, and compare them. And there's this new way of doing visual effects, which is what they're calling it in SwiftUI, where instead of using like a geometry reader and messing up your whole layout in order to be able to read the like the actual shape of a view, you can add this modifier and it gives you a proxy to the view itself, but to the rendered view. And then you can apply those modifiers. And of course, it's only a subset of modifiers because you can't change layout. You can only change the visual appearance of the view. So you can do like scaling effects and blurs and whatnot. And there was nothing in there that could do like a mask. So I just wrote a shader that does the masking and it worked.
Perfect. And I think this is both really interesting to get this capability in SwiftUI, because one thing I think has been lacking in SwiftUI is kind of different layout faces, if you will. Like here's mm-hmm. the face where the view is actually getting sized and put into the overall layout. And then there are other faces where you're just kind of, like you're saying, applying effects or manipulating the view inside of its own bounds. And this is something that I've done quite a lot already with the both UIKit and AppKit bridging APIs, where you can bridge to, for example, UIKit, have your own UI view, and then you can update that UI view inside of it without even, you know, notifying SwiftUI about those updates, because you're not doing it through the SwiftUI state management system. And that is powerful, because then you can do kind of internal updates that are much more performant, that doesn't actually invalidate the entire surrounding view and doesn't require a lot of new layout computations. But the downside is you have kind of two sources of truth, right? Where you need to be very careful not to make the UI view go off in a different direction and then being not at all in sync with the Swift UI state. But with new APIs like this, even though writing your own custom shader is perhaps, you know, not the first solution you should jump at if you just need to like mm-hmm. add a bit of effect or something, but it was great that you could achieve what you wanted to achieve with that. But it's great to see these kind of APIs being added now with more kind of different layout phases and post-processing effects. It just gives us more flexibility, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can create some really interesting effects as well. Like you can, I don't know, break your view up into Lego pieces maybe, or I don't know, make like a... Remember the old dashboard wave effect when you dropped a thing on the desktop? That would be fun as well to do as a shader.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like in general, when we move to VisionOS, if that's what's going to happen, that a lot of developers who are now iOS developers are also going to start working with VisionOS, similar to how a lot of iOS developers are now also working on the Watch and on the iPad and some on the Apple TV and so on. If that's going to be like a new major platform that many of us are going to work on, I think one kind of expectation to have going into it is that a lot of us, we're going to need to learn a lot more about things like how to write shaders or how to work with 3D technologies and how to work with 3D models and vertices and lighting and shadows and all these sorts of things that are very relevant in the 3D space. And it's definitely going to require a little bit of relearning for a lot of people. Like, personally, I've been working quite a bit with 3D, but still, like, I'm definitely not a shader expert or something like that. Like, I will definitely also need to brush up on some of those skills. But I think, personally, that's really exciting. Like, it's really cool to, on the one hand, like we talked about, have a familiar set of tools with Swift UI and so on, and with that windowed rendering that you can kind of start with. But then you can kind of start adding shaders and 3D models and other things to your application and make it more kind of an interesting Vision OS app. And you can kind of do that and learn about that in a step-by-step fashion. And I think that's really, really great.
Yeah, and these SwiftUI modifiers that allow you to use shaders, you basically only have to worry about writing the actual shader function itself. And they even give you like what the signature of the function is supposed to be. And it's really easy to pass parameters into it and whatnot. And if you wanted to do it before, you would have to do a lot of boilerplate code.
Set up a whole metal pipeline, right?
Yeah, just to get your actual shader code to run, it was a lot of code, like really a lot of code. So the fact that you can just drop it into a SwiftUI modifier now is a huge improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so the next thing we were betting on was that there would be a new control center on iOS, which unfortunately did not happen, at least not on iOS, right, Rambo?
Not on iOS. We did get a really nice control center redesign on tvOS, so I think there was a case of like the telephone game where someone got the wrong information in the end. And the rumor was iOS, but we got a redesigned control center on tvOS.
Right. But what's really, really funny for me was that we spent like a large part of that discussion talking about how cool wouldn't it be if you can add widgets there and how widgets could be this powerful thing where they could be interactable and so on. And that actually happened. Like, we didn't bet on that, but we now have interactive widgets that can even be on the desktop, on the Mac. And they can even be like running from the iPhone, but projecting onto the Mac, which is kind of wild.
Yeah, it's WatchKit all over again, right?
Exactly. On slightly more powerful hardware, though, which might, you know, make it a little bit more smooth this time.
Yeah, true. And I have been trying that out. Of course, I do have my own desktop widget system I've been working on for AirBuddy 3, but I managed to make it work with the desktop widgets native to Sonoma. So it's not a big deal. They've been working together quite well. But I'm surprised at how well the over-the-air widgets work on macOS, even on this first beta. So yeah, thumbs up for that.
Yeah, I think one key aspect of it is kind of the widget architecture itself, which was from the beginning designed to be kind of a synchronous, where the extension can be woken up, generate a whole bunch of widget snapshots over a timeline, and then those can be rendered without really the extension having any work to do at all. And it seems also watching some of the sessions that they kind of leveraged that to just add kind of a networking step in between. Just add that. How hard can it be? And kind of taking those archives, those serialized versions of the widget UI, sending them over the network to the Mac, and then the Mac can render that, you know, according to the different timestamps. And of course, interactions make that a little bit more complicated, but I feel like the base architecture of the widget system was really, really clever and really makes features like this possible in a much, much smoother way when you have that cache of things to render. You don't have to always ask the iPhone in real time, like 60 frames per second, what am I rendering now? What am I rendering now? You just already know what you're going to render.
Yeah. And of course, I wrote a widget for Chibi Studio that's the whole app basically in a widget that will absolutely not be approved for the App Store, but I did it anyway.
Exactly. Because widgets are not mini apps, Rambo, remember?
Right.
All right, next up, let's talk about the Mac Pro. So this one was, we were kind of a bit cautious here. We didn't know if this was really going to happen, but we did bet on it, and it actually did happen. So we have a new Mac Pro powered by the M2, the M2 Ultra, and it has even expansion slots. So you can put PCIe cards in the new Mac Pro, but not GPUs, which is, I want to say interesting, but I think I will go with strange as the adjective instead.
Yeah, it is a really weird product. Of course, this probably does fill some hole in the market, But is the hole big enough to justify this product existing as it is right now? Because that M2 Ultra inside that big Mac Pro case, it's chilling in there. It's going to freeze inside of that huge case with a lot of power to a lot of capability to dissipate power and fans and whatnot. So yeah, probably like there are recording studios with audio interfaces and things like that that will benefit from this. But it's a lot more expensive than the Mac Studio with the same chip. So yeah. Ugh.
Yeah, this really to me feels like sort of a backup plan. And we've even heard rumors about there being like a M2 Ultra times two, similar to how the M2 Ultra is the M2 Max times two, right? Like a four times M2 Max chip. But that didn't happen for some reason, probably because of engineering complexity or maybe like yields and demand and so on and so forth. But now what we have here is the same Ultra chip as is in the Mac Studio. And to your point, in a much, much more expensive product with very limited, if you look at it in the grand scheme of things, expansion abilities, because not only can't you install additional GPUs, which, you know, is a very, very big use case for a lot of people, not just for gaming or something, but for AI, for graphics processing in general, rendering and so on. Like having external GPUs is kind of a must for a lot of people like that. Yeah. And also RAM, like you can't expand the RAM at all here on this product. And it's just to me feels like there's a lot of compromises here. And it feels like a type of product that you would make if you had to give up on the initial plan and go to some kind of backup plan where it's like, let's just make the M2 Ultra with a very limited set of expansion here. And yeah, it's a very, very strange one.
Yeah, definitely.
And what's also kind of, you know, sad or you know, concerning maybe a little bit here is that we've been talking, or the whole community has been talking a lot about the in the context of the Mac Pro, is how will Apple Silicon scale to kind of the high end? Because we've seen that in the lower slash mid end, I mean, even Apple Silicon's low end is not very low, right? Like even when you buy just a MacBook Air or a Mac Mini, you're getting an amazing computer and great performance. But then the question was, how will that scale kind of upwards to more high-end devices where we could get a lot more compute and a lot more CPU power, RAM, and so on? And the answer is kind of, well, they didn't scale it to the high end. Like that didn't actually happen. Again, it's the same M2 Ultra, which is a high-end chip by itself if as an SoC, but if you compare it to kind of the wider technology industry with other CPU, GPU vendors, it's not like a, you know, number one performer. And that I feel like it's a little bit sad, that I would love to see an Apple, kind of complete Apple Silicon take on like the most high-end machine you can imagine, even though I would never buy it because not for me and I don't have that kind of budget for buying my computers, but it's still something I would love to see.
Yeah, me too. And it's definitely a bit strange how they're going about this, but like you mentioned, maybe this is a stopgap before something different comes out. But and it's interesting that we've been talking about it, and it sounds like we're saying that this is a terrible machine, but it's not. It's a great machine. It's just weird in context.
Yeah, I think what would make it a great machine and what would really kind of differentiate it from the Mac Studio would be if you had third-party GPU support, even if it was just AMD GPUs, like was the case with previous Mac Pros. And also RAM expansion. Like, I feel like that would make this a much, much more kind of interesting product to look at just from a kind of technology perspective. Even, again, I wouldn't really be in the market for it, but still it would be something that's interesting to look at, like, and probably something you could really, really push to have amazing performance in the GPU department if you were able to put multiple external GPUs in there. But yeah, that's not happening now, which just, it's not a terrible machine, absolutely not, but it's just not very interesting in the current shape, which, yeah, I guess that's, it is just what it is.
Yeah, definitely.
Moving on then, something that didn't happen was that Apple did not introduce a new way to download apps. And this is something that I was quite confident that they wouldn't introduce, but you, Rambo, you were betting on it. You just gave it 2 points, so it's a kind of a cautious bet there. But they did not introduce, and as far as I know, there hasn't even been any kind of press releases, sessions, anything like that regarding any kind of sideloading technologies or anything like that in this year's operating systems, right?
Yeah, we did get support for notarization in Xcode Cloud, but for Mac apps, of course. Hey, maybe they're preparing for the future. Who knows? But yeah, I'm not surprised we didn't hear about it. It was a hopeful bet, and I was wrong, of course. But there you go.
Yeah, we will see what's going to happen, of course, as different pressure builds up around the world for Apple to add features like this. We will see how they will actually implement it, but not for this year's WWDC.
Yeah.
Next up, we had a bet that we think that the new headset, which we now know is called the Vision Pro, would be able to be used as a Mac external display. And that did happen, and I think it's a pretty cool feature, like that you can actually have a 4K display inside of your virtual environment, and it's connected to your Mac, presumably via AirPlay, and you can actually use a keyboard and mouse and everything to work with it in your headset.
And the way you activate it is by looking at your Mac, of course.
Yeah, that's super cool. And that's something I wanted to mention earlier. I feel like, you know, you mentioned your article that you wrote, like the AR skepticism article. And you mentioned there that, you know, with a headset, AR could become a lot more usable because you could just look at things and things would appear or things would happen. I feel like this is one of the few things they demoed, at least so far, of that type of functionality for the Vision Pro, that you can actually look at your Mac and bring it into your virtual environment. I hope that there will be a lot more things like that. And of course, there will be a lot of third-party opportunities to build things like that. Like, I'm imagining things like, if your iPhone is lying on the table, you could look at it and see the battery overlaid on top. Or if you have any notifications, even though the iPhone itself does not light up its screen, but it's rendered in augmented reality in your Vision Pro on top of the iPhone. For example, like adding additional metadata like that to the world around you, I feel like is such a huge potential for AR, even if it's in a device like Vision Pro, which is not something you will walk around with, you know, outside every single day. And I feel like the Mac, bringing the Mac into that environment is kind of a nice first example of that type of functionality.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that they're not telling us just yet. I think that initial presentation was focused on the core experience, and the demos they gave were also focused on the core experience. But I do think they probably have a lot of these things planned for the future. And there was probably also, I mean, probably not, that there were, we are sure that there was a lot of secrecy involved in the development of this product. So I think anything that involves integrating tightly with other platforms and people who were teams of people who were not involved in the development of this product, who didn't have a need to know to actually be disclosed on its existence before it was announced, all of that stuff is not ready for demo yet, and of course not ready for launch. But we are probably going to see lots of experiences like this coming up in future releases. And it's clear that this is not the product Apple wants to ship. Even though it is quite impressive, it's the initial version of something that you can walk around with outside, for example. But this is like the very first version that they were able to achieve that's minimally viable as a product, I guess. So this is like the basic product, even though it's really advanced, that they could ship to start having things happen, so that in 10, 15 years, we could all wear glasses to have this technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like they could almost put like a big red text in front of the product on the front side that says early adopter. Because everything like, you know, about the platform, the price, absolutely. Like you said, the technology, the form factor, to me, it all says that this is very much like an early adopter type of product. The battery pack definitely could have a big early adopter sticker on it, because it feels like a compromise that was made to be able to even ship this thing using the technology we have today and without making the headset itself super heavy, right? So yeah, I absolutely agree with you. This is a very first iteration of what will hopefully be a lot of iterations over the next couple of years to make this into something, something that you can wear, something lightweight that has also somehow amazing battery life. I don't know if it will have a little nuclear reactor inside of it or how this will work according to the physics, or maybe it draws power from you and you have to just eat a lot of food to have it stay powered. I don't know.
Yeah, seeing what they've been doing with AirPods, which we didn't have any AirPods-related bets, but there was a big announcement for AirPods, for specifically for the second generation AirPods Pro, which is the new adaptive audio and also smart volume and speech awareness, which I have been trying out because I did install the beta firmware on my AirPods Pro second gen, of course. I mean, I am, if there's one person in the planet who's justified in installing beta software on AirPods, it's me, right? Because I make an app that deals with them. And it was very good because I was able to get a beta of everybody with support for the new features out last week. And it's really impressive what the AirPods can do in such a small form factor. And yeah, like it's just really quite remarkable that I can be walking around and if a loud truck goes by, it intelligently and very subtly lowers the volume of the truck for me. And if I start speaking to someone, it will pause my podcast or lower the volume of the music I'm listening to. And this is all happening in this tiny device with a tiny battery. Of course, battery life is not perfect for AirPods, and it does decrease quite rapidly over time. And they are just a satellite device for your other devices. But even then, I think it's quite remarkable. So it's not impossible for me to believe that in 15 years, we'll have something that resembles glasses that you can wear more freely. And maybe then it will be your iPhone that's doing all the processing and running all of the apps, and the glasses will just be a satellite device. Who knows?
Yeah, I think even though I joke about it, like we should definitely not underestimate the power of miniaturization over time. I mean, just look at the Apple Watch, right? Like the Apple Watch even started, like what you just mentioned, as kind of a satellite device to the iPhone, but now it's more or less a standalone device. And if you look at your Apple Watch, it's you can imagine a sizable battery like that actually somehow fitting in the frame of glasses if batteries can be shaped in that kind of form and so on, which again might happen in 15 years. So absolutely, I don't think it's impossible at all, but it's right now kind of in the realm of science fiction. But as we know, a lot of sci-fi tends to become real, at least the technological aspects of it, over time in one way or another.
Yeah, definitely. Like the stuff I was talking about for the AirPods, if you mentioned that stuff to me 5 years ago, I would say, no, you're crazy. Like this is never going to happen, or it will happen in 50 years. This is science fiction, but here it is. It's happening and it works. So yeah, we should definitely not underestimate the power of miniaturization.
Exactly. But going back to the Vision Pro and it being able to act as a Mac display, I think having those types of features, similar to what we talked about around the UI idioms actually being Windows for the most part, is great because it kind of makes being an early adopter easier, where you can treat it as an external screen for your Mac and continue working on your Mac. You don't have to go all in on Vision OS as long as you have like a laptop or something you could have with you when you're using the Vision OS Vision Pro product. So yeah, I think features like this are really important for kind of early adoption and to get things started.
Definitely.
Next up, we have the journaling app for iOS or for most Apple platforms, I believe. And that did also happen. Don't know if there's that much to say about this other than I think that the design was really, really nice. I think Apple's modern kind of UI design when they build new apps like Freeform and now this journaling app looks fantastic. Like I feel like it's like kind of a super nice mix between what we previously would call skeuomorphism with more kind of personality and the more kind of quote unquote flat design of the last decade or so, where things kind of now are still kind of not very textured, but they have more color, more personality, more depth to them. And I feel like that's working out really well.
Yeah, the health app on iPad is also really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. So thumbs up to that. I don't know, do you have any other comments on the journaling app? Is this something you're excited about or is it another app on your phone?
I'm happy that they're doing it. I think there are some really interesting ideas in the app itself, and some of which I had thought about when I was thinking about what Apple might do for a journaling app, such as the whole machine learning-based generation of a diary entry where you get a predefined set of activities and photos and maps and whatnot, and you can basically fill in your feelings and thoughts and have a nice diary entry. I could maybe see myself using that if I'm like traveling and I want to have like a more complete memory of a given travel day or something like that, or a place I visited. I'm not a person who journals daily as some people do, but I do know of a lot of people who do it, and I do know that many therapists recommend it as like a treatment basically for something. So I do think it's nice that they're offering an option natively for users, and I think it's another one of those things that it's easy to look at this and think, oh, Apple is Sherlocking a bunch of journaling apps, but I usually don't see that as being the case, and I do think that in this case it's just bringing attention to that you can use these devices for journaling.
Yeah, exactly. And also it feels like they're kind of using journaling as a wider thing that you can use for many different reasons. Like what you mentioned, you know, you can do it for yourself, you can do it privately. But a lot of things that they emphasized here on in the app when they were demoing it is you can build nice journals or nice like entries, nice articles to share with other people, right? With images and things maybe from a trip, like you mentioned. So it can become something you might do for yourself, but also something you might create, like use as a way to create like a summary of a trip and then you share it with your family or something like that. So yeah, I also think it's great that this app exists for many different reasons. And it's going to be interesting to see what people use it for. And maybe I will use it myself too. I don't know. I will definitely try it.
Yeah.
And the last bet that we made during our poker game was that there will be new iOS 17 features that use the new hardware somehow in the iPhone 14 Pro and Pro Max. And there specifically, we were talking about the always on display. And Apple did introduce a feature related to that, which is the kind of new nightstand mode where you can get a nice horizontal view of your iPhone with the always on display. For example, when you're putting it as a nightstand next to your bed or something, you can see like the clock and so on. And I feel like this is a really neat way to get some additional functionality out of your iPhone, especially when it now does have an always on display.
Yeah, definitely.
So really cool to see. And if we sum up all the points that we got during this poker game, you, Rambo, you got 14 points. So no minus points this time, 14 plus. So great job.
Nice.
And I got 18 points. So this was one of the rare occasions where I actually won the game, which is really, really fun. So it's great that you don't always win, Rambo, even though you win most of the games we play. I feel good to have at least one victory here.
Nice. Yeah, congratulations. And good to see that we both got a lot of points and no minus points.
Exactly. That's what we love to see. As long as everyone kind of has plus points and we made good bets, then it's all good. So yeah, thanks a lot. That was a really, really great game.
Awesome.
But now, even though we have already talked quite a bit about the Vision Pro, I think it just, because it's a brand new platform from Apple, it will, if it becomes a success, have a pretty big impact, I feel like, on the community and us as developers, because likely a lot of us will actually start developing for it in one way or another. So I think definitely we should do a dedicated segment here at the end, just what our first impressions are after watching the keynote, watching a few sessions about it, even though we haven't tried it ourselves yet, which is a big caveat, very few people have. Just share some initial thoughts about it. So, Rambo, we've already talked quite a bit about the different like UI idioms and so on. But besides that, what are some of your kind of initial first impressions after seeing the unveiling of the Apple Vision Pro?
Yeah, so just to get this out of the way, I don't think they've done a good job at showing what it's for, like what problem it solves. I don't think that's been answered, but I don't think that's necessarily a problem. But of course, that plays into whether any given person is going to decide to invest in the device, which is very expensive in this initial version. But I don't think it's one of those things where you see it and you're like, oh, I need to have this right now, yesterday. I don't think that's the case. However, I do think they've done a good job at developing a platform for this spatial computing, which is what they're calling it. There's a really good MKBHD video that came out this weekend, I think, where he talks about all the terms, so basically the words Apple did not say during the keynotes or anywhere, basically. So no metaverse. They didn't say virtual reality in the keynotes or anywhere, I don't think.
Even though they are technically building a VR headset.
Exactly. But that's because that's not their vision for Vision Pro.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I do think that they are way more invested in augmented reality. And that makes me happy because that's where I see myself using a device, is for augmenting reality and not for having a complete virtual reality, which is what most devices do these days. And they are mostly focused on gaming and similar experiences. And that's not something that I'm particularly interested in. So having a thing that's focused on being a platform for augmented reality is really exciting for me, even though I do see myself maybe getting this first version of the product just to develop something for it, see what it's like, start to get experience with it. But I don't see it as something I would use every day or like, oh, I'm going to, instead of sitting on my desk and using my studio display, I'm going to use the virtual Mac display. I don't see myself doing that a lot. But some of the entertainment things are interesting, like the 3D movie stuff, because I don't like 3D movies at the theater. But that experience of viewing them in the headset, I think, is very different from a movie theater where the glasses are doing polarization and you have the dim screen and things like that. So that's going to be interesting. I like that they seem to have done something they've done for pretty much every major product they've done. And I don't think they talked about it in the keynote, but famously, like when Steve Jobs announced the iPhone, he mentioned the mouse and how that solved the input problem for computers and how the click wheel was key for the success of the iPod. And then came multi-touch. And from the reactions I'm seeing from people who have actually tried this and who have way more experience with this sort of thing than I do, people such as MKBHD and other people, it's that the whole eye and hand tracking that they've done is kind of like multi-touch for AR, basically. That it's right. It's something that it's hard for us to remember, but touch screens before multi-touch, they were terrible. Like,
I remember, Rambo. Yeah. I had one of those stylus phones that Steve Jobs was making fun of in the keynote when he introduced it and said, who needs a stylus, right? I had a stylus, and I can tell you, when I got my iPhone, I was happy to throw that stylus away.
Yeah, exactly. So the hand tracking and eye tracking was the who needs a stylus moment from that keynote. And I do think that they did point out, like, you don't need any controllers or things like that. And I think that's the big thing about this, is how they've managed to create an augmented reality device that you can actually participate in your reality while using the device. Even though this first version is, it's probably not very comfortable to wear and has the battery pack thing and all of that stuff. But if you want to pick up your iPhone and tap on your iPhone while wearing the headset, you can. And if you want to talk to someone while wearing the headset, you can. And all of these things that are not easy to achieve. And from the people who have tried the very small and very prepared demo that they had at DubDub, it seems like they managed to achieve an experience that allows you to really be in reality while wearing the device. So I think that's the big achievement.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I think it's very, very useful to split up this product into two kind of aspects that I'm looking at it from two different perspectives. And the first one is kind of the technological aspect of what they've actually achieved here. And it's kind of funny, we talked about it being like a compromised first adopter, early adopter type of product, like as a first iteration of what they actually want to build. But let me be clear here, this is a technical marvel, right?
Right.
Like, this is an incredibly impressive technical achievement, what they've built here. Even though, yes, it does have compromises like the battery pack, the 2-hour battery life without being connected. And Rambo, it's amazing. It has unlimited battery life if you connect it to power. This is incredible. Something only Apple can do, right?
Right.
So the technical aspects, like the resolution of the displays, like people who have tried it say that it feels like true retina resolution. And with the amount of pixels, like 4K or more than 4K per eye, it should be, right? Like it seems incredible in that way with the HDR and 3D and everything you mentioned there around the kind of technical aspects and the different interaction models that they've come up with. All seems incredibly interesting from a technical perspective. And for that reason alone, I can't wait to try this. Like, the price tag is huge, yeah. But I definitely want to try it because I find it just so interesting from a technical perspective. That being said, though, so there's the other perspective that I'm looking at this from, and that kind of relates to what you were saying, that they didn't really show what is this really for. Like, what device does this quote-unquote replace, or what kind of use cases is this really, really for? And they did show a bunch of things, like from media consumption to actual work, productivity, and so on. But when I look at this from a kind of a usefulness angle, I have a kind of hard time to imagine it being more useful than the current setup that I have here that I'm working with. So an external display, my laptop that I can take with me wherever I go, my iPhone that I can use, you know, for a very ultra portable device, and so on. Like this for me, when I look at it just from a kind of usefulness perspective, just this product and just imagining it without having used it, it doesn't feel like perhaps it's going to be incredibly useful for me personally as a first kind of iteration of this type of product. And related to that as well, I talked about earlier that it feels very much like this device is running quote unquote iPad class apps. And iPad is, you know, a fantastic device. It has amazing apps, and a lot of people can get a lot of work done on an iPad. And those types of people will probably also be able to get a lot of work done on the Vision Pro. But you know, Rambo, our long-time listeners know that I tried this. I tried this experiment as a developer to use the iPad almost for a whole year as my primary portable device. And at the end, I just got so tired of it that I pretty much haven't worked on the iPad since. Because right. You have to jump through so many hoops to be able to actually get your work done as a developer like me, I should say, because maybe you're another kind of developer who can actually use some of the apps that are available on the iPad and get a lot of work done. Well, fantastic, then awesome. But as an iOS and Mac developer, getting work done on an iPad, like real development work, not just prototyping and so on, but actually building features and having all of those things, was really hard to do only on the iPad without also having the fallback of a Mac or a server in the cloud or something like that. And I fear that the Vision Pro will be similar. Hopefully, they will bring Xcode and everything to the iPad and Vision Pro and everything over time. And then more developers, perhaps myself included, will be able to actually use this platform for development work. But when I look at it today and I look at the type of apps they've shown and the type of experiences they've shown and also the SDK and the type of platform it's running, it just seems to me to be very much in the iPad category in terms of the apps that it supports. And, you know, an open question here is also like, will you be able to have a terminal on this thing? Will you be able to install like whatever software you want, run command line tools, run scripts? Will you be able to, if you want to preview a new version of Swift, like I often do on my Mac, will you be able to do that on the Vision Pro?
I'm sure you won't.
Exactly. And I understand that because, you know, they have to start somewhere. But when I'm thinking about AR and this potentially being the future of computing, is the future of computing again going to be a completely closed platform, just like the iPad, the iPhone, and the other Apple products have been introduced recently? And that kind of makes me, I don't want to say anxious or something, but I just wish that we wouldn't be going so much into this closed future where we just have to get things from the App Store. Hopefully that will change though with changes in the future where you will be able to do sideloading. But even with sideloading, like the fact that the Mac is still Apple's only like truly open platform where you can install whatever software you want, run whatever you want, it just makes it so as a developer, again, for me personally, it's really the only platform that makes me truly productive for my actual development work. And that just makes me a little bit skeptical towards Vision OS as a productivity tool right now, as it's shown. But I don't want to be too negative, and I, of course, want to keep an open mind, and hopefully in the future I will feel differently. But when I look at it today, I think it's a technical masterpiece from what I can see. It looks absolutely incredible from a technical perspective, but when I look at it as a potential work tool for me, I just don't see it right now.
Yeah, I think I agree, and I am hopeful though, because I do think the likelihood is more towards Apple's closed platforms. Like, if you asked me, I don't know, 5 years ago again, if what do you think is more likely? Will the Mac become as closed off as iPad and iPhone and App Store only and all of that stuff? Or will Apple open up the other platforms more? I would say, oh, they're definitely closing down the Mac. When they move to Apple's own processors, the Mac will be just like the iPad and iPhone. But that didn't happen. And these days, with the pressures around them, I think it's more likely that the other platforms become more open rather than they closing down the Mac even more. They've been doing a lot of really good work on macOS, which is not talked about that much because macOS is such an established platform, and it's honestly boring for most people. But every year they introduce incredible new security features on macOS, all of which work regardless of whether you're downloading an app from the App Store or from a developer directly with notarization. And I think that just proves that technically iPhone and iPad could be more open without compromising their security.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked about this a lot. And I've done a lot of research into this and have actually helped Apple improve their security as well, right? With the bug bounty program. So absolutely, I do believe that over time it will improve. But still, kind of the fundamentals of the platforms, like the Mac being kind of open by design fundamentally with the kind of Unix underpinnings, which I know also exist on iOS, but in a very different kind of way, where I feel like anytime the iPad becomes more powerful, it's because Apple explicitly added a specific support for one specific type of workflow. For example, let's take the Files app as an example, or Shortcuts. Like, those are powerful tools, and a lot of people can use them to get their work done. That's fantastic. But they're still, like, made for some specific types of use cases. And every year, they open up new capabilities in Shortcuts that now you can automate this, or now you can automate that. And that's awesome. But on the Mac, you can kind of inherently do anything because the platform is just so open. So it's not just about where you install your apps from my perspective. It's also about, like, how flexible is this as a work tool? And I'm hoping that over time, if VisionOS is indeed kind of the future of computing, then I hope that it can get there. But it seems to me so far that it's more kind of in the vein of iOS, that is more locked down, more limited, and you can do the things that Apple tells you can do on it, but nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the whole thing with the whole app model on iPad, for example, that does not make sense anymore, given the power of the devices. But I think we are probably in a period of transition. I think the most recent example is, like, you get Final Cut Pro for iPad, and if you are exporting a project, you have to leave the app open on screen. Otherwise, it will stop. And it even tells you, like, hey, please don't close the app because it's going to stop exporting. And you have all of those sort of things. Like there's SSH apps for iPad, and I think I use Prompt from Panic. Not sure if it's even still out or not, but it's a good app. And whenever I'm doing anything like that, which is not very frequent, but if I go to, I don't know, 1Password to grab, like, my SSH key or something and come back to the app, it's disconnected. And not because the app is bad or something. It's just because the way that the app and process model works on iPad is basically the same as on the iPhone. And that does not make sense anymore because iPad is not an iPhone. And currently, we're still at a point where if apps want to stay alive in the background, they have to jump through these hoops and, like, play silent audio in the background in order to keep running or something.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like all those limitations, at least how it looks like so far on VisionOS, because it's built on the same kind of technological platform, will be brought over to the VisionOS platform. And, you know, will you end up in a situation where you know, you're on that battery life, that 2 hour battery life, you're exporting some project and there's a race against time. Will the battery run out before your export completes, right? Or right. You're wearing the headset and you need to go to the bathroom, but you can't take the headset off because you're exporting some file. And then you leave your calendar app in the bathroom as a result, right? It feels like there are all of these things. And now when you're listening to this, you might say, well, John, Rambo, you're being unfair here. Like, this is a first generation product. It's not even out yet. Like, it's probably like a year more or less until it comes out. Longer than that for us because, you know, we live in Brazil and in Poland. So it will take longer for our markets to get this product likely. But still, like, I feel like, why are we looking at it from this perspective then? Like, if this was a VR gaming headset or a VR movie watching headset, we wouldn't really be talking about those things at all, right? But it's because of the way it was shown and pitched in the keynote, where it was primarily, I would say, shown as a work tool. And with the price tag as well, it better be a good work tool to warrant that. And this is what I feel the reason why we're looking at it this way and thinking about these things, like how useful will this be as a work tool as it currently exists or will exist soon? And things would be very, very different for me if it was a lower price, if it was using different use cases, like, you know, more focused on entertainment, gaming, and so on. Then I wouldn't even think about, like, how of a useful of open of a computing platform is this. But because the device is, it feels like, at least to a very big extent, pitched as a work tool, I think these questions will pop up, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So I just want to kind of wrap up from my personal perspective that I am excited about this product. Don't get me wrong. I think it's, like I said many times now, it's incredible from a technical perspective, and I can't wait to see where this goes. I can't wait to try it myself. But at the same time, I'm kind of just, you know, a little bit skeptical, or I'm at least keeping my eye on how useful do I think this will be as a work tool, and, you know, how will the platform continue to evolve. And then we'll see if it's going to be a device for me or not. And if it's not a device for me, then that's also okay. Like, I'm at the point now where I don't feel like every Apple device needs to be for me or otherwise it's bad. there are many Apple devices I haven't bought and I don't think they're bad products. It's just they don't fit into my particular life. So perhaps I'll just keep using my Mac and be happy with that. But we will definitely see. But regardless, super cool to see a new platform from Apple. Super cool to see another big company enter into the AR VR space, because that will probably lead to a lot of competition and additional innovation. Overall, I think it's a very positive thing and I'm very excited about this platform in general. But I think it creates a lot of questions that I like to think about, like to discuss, even though sometimes they might sound a bit negative, but they're really not. They're just, you know, questions. And I just want to see where this platform will go in the future.
Exactly. We're just exploring the thing for now. And I'm sure maybe after we try it out for ourselves, maybe we'll have a different opinion. Who knows?
Probably. It will probably be like, you know, we're kind of skeptical now. And then we go into a demo room and we come out like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever.
Right.
The demos that they did show seem to have that effect on people. Like, again, I'm sure it's like mind blowing from just kind of a, you know, you're using it for the first time kind of point of view, right?
Yeah, I'm sure that people who actually tried it have a very different view than someone like you and me. But hey, we didn't get the opportunity, unfortunately.
Exactly. Maybe next time. So that's the end of this post-WWDC wrap-up episode. So hope you enjoyed listening to us talk about the poker bets and kind of the result of them and some of the announcements, as well as, of course, VisionOS and Vision Pro. We'll dive a lot more into some of our new favorite APIs that we've been starting to use, some of the new Swift features, and so on as we kind of move along the beta cycle, as we start implementing more of these things in our own projects, and of course, share our experiences with you. But until then, thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you again on the next episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.